Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast. Today is Thursday, January 19th, 17th, 2019. I'm still writing 2017 on my checks. Not that I write any checks. I'm John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary Magazine, the 70-odd-year-old monthly of intellectual analysis, political probity, and cultural criticism from a conservative perspective. We invite you to join us at CommentaryMagazine.com, where we give you a few free reads, ask you to subscribe, $19.95 for a digital subscription, and $29.95 for an all-access subscription, including our beautiful monthly magazine in your mailbox 11 times a year. We just closed our February issue. We will be talking about a very important issue article in that issue with its author in a little bit. That author is social commentary columnist Christine Rosen, back after a couple of shows away. Hi, Christine.
Hi, John.
And with me in studio, senior editor Abe Greenwald. Hi, Abe.
Hi, John.
And associate editor Noah Rothman. Hi, Noah.
Hi, John.
So we thought maybe we'd shift gears away from the gorilla, the 800-pound gorilla or elephant or whatever in the room, or the 800-pound gorilla or something, and reflect on what is going on with the Democratic Party, the National Democratic Party, in the weeks after the shutdown started and Democrats took control of Congress, and I think four or five candidates have now basically said they were running for president, either explicitly and officially or slightly unofficially. Those are, by my count, Elizabeth Warren, Joaquin Castro, Kristen Gillibrand. Who am I forgetting?
Tulsi Gabbard.
And
John
Delaney.
Who
was a congressman from New Jersey, I believe.
Maryland,
okay. And I think it is fair, and of course, the pre-launch campaign of Beto O'Rourke, the now former congressman from Texas who made an incredibly close stab at winning the Texas Senate seat away from Republican Ted Cruz. It seems to me, and then you add to that controversies erupting daily over our dear friend Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and the two female Muslim members of Congress, Rashida Tlaib of Michigan and Ilhan Omar from Minnesota. And I think if you all who are getting enormous amounts of media attention that is maybe not that great for them, and we can get to that a little bit, but it seems like while the Republican Party is in no great shape, as we know, it's not clear that politically or in terms of public outreach or public opinion or behavior that the Democratic Party is in all that great a condition either. Noah, what do you?
I mean, yeah, well, we're in the middle of this shutdown now, almost a month long, and it's not reflecting really well on anyone. I'm trying to pull up this NPR Marist poll, which came out today, and I can't pull it up right in front of me, but it makes sense that it would reflect poorly upon everybody involved, because Democrats had an image problem. Even going into 2018, they had an image problem. They just managed to turn out their voters. And what we've seen now from this new crop of candidates is some very charismatic, young, diverse, interesting neophytes who, when they open their mouths, start to dispel a lot of the mysticism around them, the aura around them. Obviously, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has received perhaps a little bit more attention than she deserves, and she's probably the poster child for this sort of thing. But then you have figures like Ro Khanna and representatives Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar, who is generating a lot of attention today, and are indicative of some grassroots sentiment on the left that Democrats would probably prefer to keep buried. Most notably among those sentiments is support for BDS. And I think Abe actually has some more thoughts on along those lines.
Well, it's interesting because this comes right on the heels of the DNC taking itself off the partnership list of the Women's March, do, although not explicitly stated, to the March's co-president Tamika Mallory's relationship and support for Louis Farrakhan and the general anti-Semitic vibe around the march. And so then suddenly you have Ilhan Omar is now been picked for the Foreign Relations Committee, the Congressional Foreign Relations Committee, which is, you know, like, that's so in terms of the Democrats' image as regards anti-Semitism, that's like one sort of small step forward and you know, five giant leaps backward, because now you have a supporter of BDS against Israel and someone who has, Omar, who has tweeted that Israel has hypnotized the world into disguising their evil. May Allah awake the world to the great evil they're perpetrating. Now she is actually in a position to influence policy. Foreign policy and
the Women's March thing is the most staggering hypocrisy. I mean, we just came off a week of justified outrage over Representative Steve King asking for an education in why white supremacy is bad. He certainly got one. He's been stripped of his committee positions, and the national conversation now is, well, what took so long? It's not like Rep. Steve King was really hiding his racial antagonism and an enlightenment, and that's fair. It's perfectly fair. But at the same time, I mean, we just came off this Women's March scandal, and the DNC is now acknowledging that it's a scandal. And at the same time, you have Linda Sarsour, who is in Congress, in the Capitol building, on January 3rd, as these representatives were being sworn in. Representative Tlaib and Omar met with her. She was the first constituent.
Okay, I think we need to slow down and just introduce some of the detail here for people who may not be entirely up on it. So Linda Sarsour is one of the four national organizers of the Women's March. One of the other national organizers of the Women's March, Tamika Mallory, went on The View last week, and our friend Meghan McCain did a remarkable job of demanding, essentially asking her how on earth she could associate herself in the Women's March with Louis Farrakhan, who of course is called Jews Termites, who said someday soon we will punish you with death, is the most virulent anti-Semite on the sort of African-American, Islamic left, whatever you want to call it. And she refused to do it. She refused to, and this came on the heels of a remarkable piece of reporting by Tablet about how anti-Semitism has been a feature of the organizing of the Women's March at the beginning, back in the fall winter of 2018, when it was being organized in the first place. And as is often the case with leftist organizers, Jewish leftist organizers, they were cowed into kind of bending their head toward the more intersectional victims of the horrors of our time, and, you know, the more authentic victims of the horrors of our time, the, you know, sort of the African American women who demanded to have a leading role and demanded that they step back and not be too showy about what they wanted.
By way of demonstrating her contrition, in an interview with the New York Times, Tamika Mallory said, "You know, I understand now that anti-Semitism affects all Jews, but white Jews do perpetuate white supremacy."
Right. Yeah. And Linda Sarsour, who is,
and the by the way, right. The Women's March, their intersectionality compels them to defend some really disreputable people, not just Louis Farrakhan, but also Asada Shakur, better known as Joanne Chesimard, who was convicted of an execution of a New Jersey state trooper. And they associate themselves with some pretty bad actors because they're all part of the same team.
Right. So Linda Sarsour, on the day that the new Congress was sworn into session, Linda Sarsour was a guest in the Congress of, I believe, it was Rashida Tlaib.
Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar. Ilhan Omar was both the very
together.
First constituent right. she met with as a congresswoman was Linda Sarsour.
Okay, so the Democratic Party. So now, we should say that because, Noah, you framed this in the Steve King context, that while a lot of us have been yelling about the threat of, you know, the radicalism of the Women's March has been overlooked and was being, you know, sort of soft-pedaled. Nonetheless, it should be said that in the wake of the tablet piece, a lot has happened very fast, and that the Democratic National Committee's decision to separate itself from the Women's March was actually kind of happened pretty remarkably quickly in the wake of an individual piece of reportage that, you know, made it incontrovertibly clear how rooted in the organization of the Women's March anti-Semitic views were. The Steve King thing, you know, I looked back and I've been going at Steve King and on social media for 5 years. So Steve King's disgusting qualities have been very much a matter of public record for a very long time. And as you say, Noah, it is perfectly fair game to say, well, so it's only now that they're in the minority, and so it doesn't matter whether they have one vote more or less, that it's okay to go after Steve King. Fine. So they did it, and it's better they did it than they didn't do it. But nobody should be getting a medal of courage for going after them. Although I think the story, the backroom story, is that Liz Cheney was elevated into a serious leadership position in the House, and I think this is her first big project, is the sort of the isolation of Steve King and the obvious effort to get Steve King to try to resign so that someone else can go into that seat. Somebody got Mitch McConnell, who would otherwise say nothing over the last month, to issue a statement against a House member, Steve King. It's kind of impressive.
I mean, why would he, though? I mean, just as kind of a digression, but Steve King is now the third member of the Republican conference in the House without any committee assignments. There are two under indictment.
Right.
That are just sticking around. I mean, everybody thinks they can weather these storms. It's really a disgrace.
Right. But I think one of the differences, though, and how the left and the right handle this, is that I think even when the right handles it poorly, which it has for a long time, the case of Steve King, as you point out, John, I think there's little question that when something racist is uttered by someone on the right, it's seen as racist, whether that's sort of taken care of or not. When something racist or bigoted happens on the left, oh, it's something else. It's right. It's intersectionality.
Well, anti-Semitism in particular has a weird place in that discussion.
Yeah.
Because what is going on with Tamika Mallory and the Women's March and the stories of how it was organized and the relationship with Louis Farrakhan, who is also, by the way, a disgusting sexist as well as a racist. I mean, the stuff that he says about women would curl your hair as well. Then we have to start getting into a whole semantic debate over whether anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism,
right.
And you know, what is just criticism of Israel? Well, I'll tell you what's just criticism. What's anti-Semitism? Calling Jews termites is anti-Semitism. That's what Farrakhan does, and the leaders of the Women's March say he's their greatest influence. So
right,
but
BDS,
it is true.
That is
right.
Then you have
BDS.
To start explaining what BDS is and that its mission is a little bit more less innocuous than
it's not innocuous at all. I mean, it's a
but you have to explain, and that's part
well.
Of
let
the
me
problem.
Put it. I will now explain. Boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Jewish organization, Jews in Israel, or businesses in Israel because of the Palestinians. Guess who organized boycotts against Jewish businesses in the 1930s? In Germany. That was the beginning, the first thing that the Nazis did when they took power in 19 was organize a boycott against Jewish-owned businesses before they seized them.
I mean,
of
the
course.
Political toxicity of this movement is evident in the fact that Representative Omar didn't come out for it until after she was elected, and it caused quite a bit of a stir that she came out for it afterwards, but being kind of general and vague about it beforehand.
Yeah, so Christine, we've been sitting here, you know, mansplaining. So
mansplaining.
Maybe you want
Well, one of the things that's interesting to me about a lot of this is the role that the social media use of a lot of these folks on the left has played into this. There's a huge amount of hypocrisy, right? So you have Tamika Mallory praising Farrakhan on Twitter, but when she's confronted directly on air, she hedges but doesn't quite back off. You've got Tlaib, remember after she said, we're going to impeach the mother, you know what her. the hashtag she used when she was asked if she was going to apologize was hashtag unapologetically me. You know, so there's this weird performance of supposed authenticity when they say something, you know, anti-Semitic or something just, you know, rude. And there must be, they must see a value in performing in this way on social media, even when confronted by, you know, as you mentioned, Meghan McCain flaying Tamika Mallory on The View. She still doesn't back off, but she's a little more accommodating than she is on social media. And I think that speaks to this broader challenge that the Democratic Party, especially the presidential hopefuls, are facing. I mean, some of them, like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, is also having, everyone says she's so brilliant at using Instagram and using Twitter, but in fact, I've noticed she's become rather testy and defensive in her use of Twitter recently when she's challenged on facts, for example. And I think people have accurately pointed out that she sounds a lot like Donald Trump in those moments, right? I mean, her Instagram stories are cute of her dancing around and whatnot, but she's going to have to be very careful in her use of social media because you can't really have it both ways, right? The kind of radical transparency that these platforms give and the direct appeal to emotion that they provide, it can be a double-edged sword for a lot of these folks.
It can be, and so that segues into the question of the launching of these early presidential bids. And what is striking about them is how badly it seems to me, I mean, except that the little ones, I mean, Tulsi Gabbard, who is basically the congressman from Damascus, I think we can sort of put to one side, because God only knows why she's running or what on earth she thinks she's doing. And not only is she pro-Syrian, but it turns out she was very much a supporter of gay conversion therapy, 15 years ago, which is like in the Democratic Party is like being for, you know, is like being for euthanasia. Being for mandatory abortion in the Republican Party, right? So I don't know if she matters, but so if you take the big three, the big three being Warren, Gillibrand, and Beto O'Rourke, who hasn't announced but is clearly running and doing some, is not good. I mean, O'Rourke in particular. So O'Rourke did
Oh,
this-
we forgot Kamala Harris.
Oh, Kamala Harris, right. Kamala, excuse me. It's Rashida Tlaib and Kamala Harris.
Very bad at this, I apologize.
So what's interesting is, so O'Rourke, who did something really unprecedented in the last month of his campaign, Beto O'Rourke raised more money per day in the last month of his campaign than anyone has ever raised ever in politics. That's more than Obama did at his height. It's more than Bernie Sanders did at his height. He raised $40 million in hard money in 28 days or something like that. It's in a single state, and all, you know, nothing like this has ever happened. He really has inflamed Democratic passions, even though he's only a three-term congressman. So in an effort to figure out what to do before he would run for office, he decided to go on this, and he does a lot of Instagram. His campaign was he was going to go to every county in Texas and do everything. He was on Instagram the whole time and driving and doing monologues while he was driving and stuff. And now he's sort of going to do this across America in some fashion. But he made this colossal mistake, which is that he Instagrammed his teeth cleaning. And the picture of him having his teeth cleaning is about as good a picture as anyone could have of their teeth cleaning, which is to say that it looks like the scene in Little Shop of Horrors when Steve Martin is pulling, you know, Bill Murray's teeth out of his head. I mean, it was disgusting. You know, nobody want to see that. And then you start saying, well, you know, this thing is weird. Like, you can destroy, you know, the problem with nothing matters anymore and all that. But also, an image like that is sort of indelible, and you could probably destroy your campaign 100 times over. This is one of the reasons that people prudently, you know, clear statements and figure out what a candidate's supposed to say and all this, because the unintended consequences of you know, exposure of your personal behavior and your life and all that, you just don't know where it's going to go.
Well, and it's and it there is a weird disadvantage if you're over the age of 30 and you try to do this, right? I mean, live streaming is no politician's friend, but they should just stick to the photo op hugging a baby. But remember when Hillary was just chilling in Cedar Rapids? Wasn't that the thing that she was using Snapchat and she became this hilarious meme because it really was like this old fogey attempt to use Snapchat. And it does give younger politicians, even the difference between an Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who's a millennial, and Beto, who's, I think, a Gen Xer, right?
He's 47.
Yeah.
One of the jokes about Beto, by the way, was all this like, he's young, he's dynamic and young, and he's so young, right? So A, he's 47. B, he's 2 years older than Ted Cruz. So there was this whole thing about how this is great. We're going to get new young blood in the Senate, not like Ted Cruz. O'Rourke is older than Ted Cruz. And one of the defenses of him by people who like him after the teeth cleaning incident was, well, he's young. He's not young.
He's not young.
He's not
young. He's older than I am.
He's not young. Clinton was younger when he became president, and so was Obama, and so was Teddy Roosevelt, and so was JFK, and none of them had a picture of them having their teeth cleaned.
Elizabeth Warren's really ham-fisted beer drinking episode in her kitchen. I'm loath to give Donald Trump credit for landing a zinger, but I think he really did I think it was him who was reflecting on that when Elizabeth Warren invited her husband in to have a beer.
She
was
oh,
like,
here's my husband.
Here's my husband. Thank you for being here. And the president was like, he's supposed to be there.
It's his
he's
house.
Your husband. He lives there.
It's his house.
It's so inauthentic and painful. And that's the
But
the
whole
pit of the
thing
Instagram
was like
generation.
That. Like, she took the beer and she had to be very careful to hide the neck of the beer so that the label wouldn't show.
Right.
So she was so, I think I'm going to have a beer. And then she kind of
Why?
Had to adjust. She got went out of camera frame, and then she brought
they
the
do
beer
that on
back.
Like,
but she's like, because she... Cause
they
she
do that on MTV reality shows. They don't have You don't have to do it on Instagram. No one's sponsoring you.
Well, I don't know why, but she didn't want to clearly, you know, she... Oh, it's like, oh, you're... Oh, Anheuser-Busch, is that right? Do you know that Anheuser-Busch, you know, buys guns? I mean, you know, that's why. So, but it was, thank you for being here, honey. Was a great moment. It's like, why are you, you know, in an effort, there's a great moment. There was a mini series in the 1970s made a Romana Clay about Watergate called Washington Behind Closed Doors, which was based on a novel by John Ehrlichman, who was one of Nixon's henchmen. And after he went to prison, he started writing novels. So Jason Robards plays Nixon. And there's a scene which is based off a famous incident where his media advisor wants to stage a bit where he looks really glamorous or something like that. And they have this scene of him on the beach in California with the sun setting, Jason Robards, and he's, you know, and so he's staying there and the waves are coming and he's in a suit and a tie and brown shoes. And somebody says to the media consultant, I don't think you want us to take this picture because who wears brown Oxford shoes on a beach with the water lapping up on at his feet? And it was, once you saw it, it was really quite a brilliantly staged scene. And all of this is the same, this kind of effort to create mythic authenticity.
But see, and I think...
Right? It's like, on the one hand, it's authentic, right? Beto O'Rourke's getting his teeth cleaned, he's driving around the country, or Elizabeth Warren's having a beer. And on the other hand, it's a kind of myth-making. It's the myth-making of the regular Joe. You know, it's George H.W. Bush saying he liked pork rinds.
Right.
Or, you know.
But I think, you know, Noah brought up Trump's response to this. And I think Trump relates in another way. Trump's campaign and whatever appeal he still has, so much of that has to do with his sort of warts and all approach to this. That, you know, he doesn't care. He's just going to say what he's going to say. He's not going to be apologetic. He's going to flub where he's going to flub. He's gonna order, you know, pedestrian food in ways that people don't approve. All that, you know, and there's an attempt to orchestrate a warts and all, a myth, self myth about yourself. So he's like, look, this is me getting my teeth cleaned, you know, and they're missing the mark. But I think they are trying to capture something of Trump's, I don't care, this is who I am, appeal.
Right. Although a lot of this is goes back to, you know, that whole, the whole thing about Elizabeth Warren is some weird evocation of that poll taken in 2000, that famous poll about whether you would like to, who would you like to have a beer with more, Al Gore or George Bush, and George Bush won, you know, by 25 points or something like that. Mm-hmm. So this is Elizabeth Warren like, yeah, I'm a 68-year-old white pseudo Cherokee, but you know, I like to crack open a beer in my Cambridge house, you know. You know, it's
a Michelob Ultra.
Oh, are you kidding? You think someone in Harvard Law School professor is going to drink a Michelob?
Hang on,
it's a beer truther.
Oh, you don't even know Michelob Ultra.
Beer truther.
Michelob, but it's a beer truther.
Isn't Ultra like the one that's barely beer? It's so low and
it's near beer. Yeah, near beer.
Oh my God. Yeah. Anyway, so there was the Warren beer. Beto's teeth.
Yes, it was a Michelob Ultra.
Okay.
She called the club soda of beers.
Okay, there you go.
Which is kind of self-deprecating and cute.
I'm trying to remember the Michelob jingle, but I only have the Löwenbräu jingle in my head.
That's the one that
came to me, problem. Too. Okay.
Yeah. Schlitz.
Schlitz. Of course, the greatest beer slogan, not to get totally off the way, was for Schaefer, which was a beer, a New York City beer, when beers were mostly regional. And Schaefer sponsored sports broadcasts, and so the Schaefer jingle was, Schaefer is the one beer to have when you're having more than one. So it's basically, it's the beer that you drink during the afternoon and you get totally sloshed and stonkered, and then you go home and beat your wife. I mean, that was effectively, that was the message of Schaefer. This is a beer to get drunk on. And then God knows what happens then. Okay, anyway. See, that would be authentic if she had a Schaefer. I don't even know if Schaefer exists anymore. But then we have Kirsten Gillibrand. So senator from New York has decided to run apparently a radically woman-centric campaign. That is to say that most female, including Hillary, right, that the danger of being a female candidate was that you would seem only like you were interested in women's issues, so you had to be a tough guy, right? You're tough on foreign policy, tough on this, tough on that. And she is only going to talk about women, apparently. This is her. And she's going to try to go to every female-led household in the United States and meet every... She said this, like, she wants to be in every living room, in every home in the United States, if that's what she could do.
If the Green New Deal can do it, so can Kirsten.
Fair enough. it is totally unclear to me what possesses Gillibrand to think, except for the fact that, you know, anyone can win anything, why she is doing this and why she's running for office. She's not a particularly able politician, and she has flip-flopped on every single issue in her... She ran as a right-wing Democrat when she won her House seat in 2006 in upstate New York. She ran as a pro-life, pro-gun, anti-financial regulation, anti-environment candidate. And she is now, you know, Miss Wokey von Wokenstein.
Well, just as a matter of institutional
politics.
But it's going
to be so easy for one of the people to her left to... slash her to ribbons in the first debate, you know, if they have to. Like, taking her down is about as easy as, you know.
Well, unfortunately, they're not going to do it as they should do it. They're going to go after her for throwing Al Franken under the bus. That's the thing that gets under Democrats' skin more than anything else, more than her flip-flops, but more than anything else. But she was effectively a creature of the Clintons. She was created by the Clintons. She was put in office by the Clintons and David Paterson. And she turned on them in a pretty spectacular fashion after the Me Too moment made Bill Clinton persona non grata. So I don't know what her base of support is in an institutional level, her power center is. She used to have some sponsors in the party, and they're gone now.
Well, the oddity of her bid is that she is a senator from New York who, one of whose calling cards would be in a more conventional election year, that she has access to a lot of big money really fast, that she can go to hedge funds and go to Goldman Sachs and do it, you know, and generate a lot of money quickly, because she, New York senators are cash machines like that, because they work on financial services as it's the leading you know, economic driver of the state of New York. And so in Washington, that's what they do. And so they have a really incestuous relationship with financial services firms. That is not going to be helpful to anybody running for office in 2020. Like, you do not want to be the candidate who raised the most money from Goldman Sachs. I mean, maybe you need money, but, you know, that money comes at an enormous price now.
She's going to face a little competition for that role from Cory Booker as well.
Yeah, but less than you think. In other words, like, if that's, I'm just saying that her calling card once would have been, well, you know, I can get $25 million really fast. All I have to do is have 7 fundraisers and bundlers at Goldman and, you know, I can't even remember the names of the, you know, and hedge, you know, Golden Tree, BlackRock, you know, they'll all fold the money together. And I, you know, like I say, like, that's just giving somebody a giant target to paste right on your forehead in a Democratic primary. So that's why I think she's doing the, I'm here for women. I'm running to be a woman. I am a woman running as a woman to be a woman. And then she called herself a young woman. She said something about how she's the representative of young women, and she's 52. I mean, I'm 57, so I love the idea that a 52-year-old is young, but that's not young. She and Beto could all, like, start a youth movement together.
How does one Democrat in this age own that issue, right? Because that is a broad issue on the left right now. Every Democrat is going to be running to some extent a female centric campaign. No,
I mean, I agree.
It's like running as the biggest hawk in
2016. Right.
But at the same time, they're going to rehabilitate Al Franken.
Well, who's going to rehabilitate Al Franken?
If you survey the base opinion of the Democrat, I'm very close to the Democrat.
I know you are.
And one of their biggest gripes with Kirsten Gillibrand is how she threw him under the bus, and it wasn't deserved. It was unjust, and right. They really are annoyed by that.
You know what? It's true, actually. I mean, the entirety of his political, he did it to himself. Right, because the idea was he had to resign because there was a photograph of him looking like he was grabbing a woman's breasts, which he wasn't doing. And the idea was, in order to rub the country's face in how Republicans supported sexual harassers and rapists, because Roy Moore was going to win the Senate seat in Alabama. Al Franken had to go. He had to sacrifice himself for the greater good of the party being able to beat Republicans about the face and neck with Roy Moore. And then Roy Moore lost. So he resigned his Senate seat to take one for the team. And then the team had no use, had nothing to do. Didn't, you know, they cleared the decks and he was out of there. And so it was interesting. It was interesting. The most interesting thing, I think, was the Clinton, was that moment at which people turned on the Clintons. I still don't know what to make of it. And I do note, by the way, if you've followed this, that Bill and Hillary have gone on a joint world speaking tour, which is apparently a colossal financial disaster.
Right, even Groupon tickets weren't selling for this thing. It was evidently.
I mean, so we really do.
That's
have
one of the reasons why I'm pretty sure that the hammer fell on Bill Clinton as he stopped being able to generate funds at fundraisers.
That's interesting. Well, so anyway, I think getting back to the sort of the general theme, the question is, at a time in which institutions are all under. Institutions are in bad odor, and the Republican Party's in bad odor, the White House is in bad odor, everything's in bad odor. It's not like the Democratic Party has somehow found some mystical ability to rise above the fray and look like it has the best interests of the country at heart. And I don't think really that these first couple of weeks suggest that they are anywhere near having their finger on the pulse of the country.
I mean, and this might seg us into our next segment, is that when I was going out saying, you know, that it's good for Steve King, you know, now Democrats need to tackle their anti-Semitism, I would also add that their casual misandry is also something, a feature of this party that they need to address. And so I got a pushback from reporters, not Democrats, but, you know, the guys who straddle the line between being Democratic partisans and reporters. Whoa. Anti-Semitism, I get, right? Because obviously there's anti-Semitism in the Democrat. That was a nice admission. But misandry, I just don't see that.
Anti-maleness is what you're talking about, right?
Right. Well, casual derision of men and masculinity.
Right.
And they absolutely didn't see it. And little things like Senator Mazie Hirono, coming out and saying, you know, men should just shut up and get behind that generality, was just seen as common sense,
right?
Not a gross generalization of an entire demographic.
What? It's not even a demographic. Isn't even the right term for it. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's half the world. Yeah. You know, 49% of the world is male, and so to say all men should shut up,
but it's difficult to quantify.
I know,
because it has become such an accepted feature of modern discourse.
Okay, we're going to get to that, but before we get to that, I want to talk to you about our new client, Capterra. Okay, remember 1999? We're officially 20 years past that, so if you're no longer partying like it's 1999, why does the software you use every day at work feel like it's not quite ready for Y2K? Start the year off on the right foot and find software that's, well, a little more up-to-date on Capterra.com. Capterra is the leading free online resource to help you find the best software solution for your business. With over 700,000 reviews of products from real software users, discover everything you need to make an informed decision. Search more than 700 specific categories of software, everything from project management to email marketing to yoga studio management software. No matter what kind of software your business needs, Capterra makes it easy to discover the right solution fast. Join the millions of people who use Capterra each month to find the right tools for their business. Now, this is an interesting thing because, you know, here at Commentary, for example, we are, you know, sometimes we get manuscripts in weird formats, for example, that don't easily and quickly translate into a word processing program that we can use or something like that. And you then have to go scramble in the Apple App Store to find some, you know, there are sort of 10 reviews, and, you know, for all you know, all those reviews have been written by people who work on the program, so how do you know? So this actually strikes me as an interesting resource in a world in which you keep having to find little bits of programming to help you, and there's 10,000 different things and you can't tell the difference. So visit capterra.com/commentary for free today to find the right tools to make 2019 the year for your business. Capterra.com/commentary. That's CAPTERRA.com/commentary. And we thank Capterra for sponsoring the Commentary Magazine podcast. Now, Christine, in our February issue, which an article I think we will have up and available on our website by the time you listen to this, you're listening to this podcast, you can go to our website and find the piece and read it. You have actually expounded at length on the degree to which the idea that masculinity itself is toxic has gone shockingly mainstream. Do you can you sort of lay it out for us?
Sure. I think the first thing to notice is that if anyone has seen the Gillette razor ad that's been making the rounds, then it would suggest that right now, John and Abe and Noah are sitting in the Commentary offices barbecuing, mansplaining, and harassing women, because this is what men do when they all get in one place together. So there's a backlash, an appropriate backlash, brewing against this Gillette ad that's trying to kind of glom on to Me Too moment values and argue for kinder, gentler masculinity. But the more disturbing thing that happened recently is a set of guidelines that was issued by the American Psychological Association. And these are guidelines that are supposed to help practitioners, therapists who treat boys and men. And they basically determine that masculinity is toxic. Their actual definition is that masculinity is a constellation of standards that have held sway over large segments of the population, including anti-femininity, achievement, eschewal of the appearance of weakness, adventure, risk, violence. And in the summary to the study that the APA posted on its website, this says that, you know, 40 years of research show that traditional masculinity is psychologically harmful, and socializing boys to suppress their emotions causes damage that echoes both inwardly and outwardly. So it's a pretty firm statement against what they're describing as traditional masculinity. But there's not a lot of evidence here. I mean, one of the things that people have read the report, I read the full guidelines, it does kind of read like a women's studies term paper in that it cites lots of these vague theoretical forces at work in society. It does not mention things like, say, testosterone. And there was a psychologist interviewed in a recent media report who said, oh, well, we don't measure testosterone. We're psychologists, you know. And yet if you look at the evidence they're marshaling for attacking masculinity, there's not a lot of science there. There's a lot of theory. So what disturbed me about it is that this isn't just, you know, a crazy women's studies professor ranting on a college campus where you can shrug and say, oh, that won't affect anyone. If you start thinking about how these guidelines might be implemented by actual therapists, whose recommendations, by the way, are used in, for example, family courts when custody issues are at stake. They're used, you know, if you have a therapist who's working with a school system, for example, there might be disciplinary matters that come up for a male student where these guidelines would be embraced. It's disturbing because a lot of the things that the guidelines overlook are the real challenges that young men in particular are facing. So, I think it's a kind of look at us, we're going into a new era for masculinity where, you know, the individual man doesn't have to be crushed by these burdensome stereotypes about how men are supposed to behave. They can be more emotional and revealing of their feelings. And this is all for the good. But I don't think it is. And I don't think that there's enough critical questioning of some of the what are considered traditionally male values, what they do that's good for society. I mean, stoicism is something and reticence is probably something we could use a little more of.
By the way, we have an enormous amount of social science literature that says precisely that one of the qualities that is being attacked here, which is, saying that what's important is to let your emotions out, that repressing your emotions is bad. And so masculinity teaches men to suppress their emotions, and that leads to enhanced violence. That, in fact, we have this, you know, decades of social science research that says that controlling your emotions, being able to, you know, contain yourself at moments of great stress, to calm yourself down, to push things down, and show self-control over your emotions is favorably connected to better health, better ability to manage yourself in the workplace, better outcomes when it comes to marriage, and child rearing and things like that. It's, you know, the marshmallow experiment writ large. And
exactly.
And so this, what strikes me as being so horrifying is that the American Psychological Association is not a particularly impressive group. They're the group that every like 5 years comes out and says, no one should ever watch television. And then they say, you should never do X. You know, you should never co-sleep with a child because that will give them bad, you know, whatever. You know, it's like, who are you people? Like, you know, who are you to sort of lay down these markers on the basis, by the way, of very little. It's often the case that it's on the basis of very little information.
Sometimes
in fact,
it feels
right?
like these things are crafted just to get pieces up.
Right.
Like,
okay. But on the other hand, you know, it is also totally conventional. In other words, it's like this is the stuff of Good Morning America and, you know, morning shows and Psychology Today, and it's intended to feed pop psych ideas, and so therefore, they're not the leading edge. They're not the cutting edge of research and stuff like that. They're reflecting some kind of general consensus in the world of sort of good, solid, middle class, conventional opinion. And if we have gone so far down this road that it is acceptable for the American Psychological Association to say to parents that the masculinity of your sons is a problem that needs to be fixed, That is terrifying.
Chris? No, and that's, I think that speaks to Noah's earlier point that this idea, this casual misandry, this sort of gender shaming of men has gone mainstream, right? We see it in these quirky ads. We see it in these reports. And that is a problem. I mean, we actually need, you know, things like, as you were saying, John, disciplined aggression and the ability to control one's emotions and whatnot, physical competitiveness. These are things we need in many areas of life, not just as soldiers, but for people who work in any number of areas. And I think that it's very, very concerning that we're seeing this embraced. In some ways, there was a very defensive reaction on the part of the APA when people started to criticize these guidelines. They seemed kind of surprised because I think, as you said, John, this has become conventional wisdom, and that should disturb us.
Christine, one of my favorite pieces of your piece, and you talked about it earlier, is how it reads like a sort of a very academic piece of feminist literature with these jargony words and secret handshakes. And it was evocative to me of these now infamous fake academic texts that were fed to these academic journals. And one of the most famous ones was the rewriting of a section of Mein Kampf using feminist jargon and intersectional feminist buzzwords. That was republished in a very prominent journal, a scientific journal, and that you can essentially pass off.
And what happened to the authors of that JAPE? They're professors at a university, I believe, in Canada, and they've been brought up on academic charges of having misused their academic position in some fashion to, you know, promulgate an anti-academic idea.
Right. Because they forced these journalists to publish a piece that suggested
that really is right.
that dogs attacking each other in a park was evidence of rape culture.
Right. I mean, look, the other thing that drives me totally crazy about this is the fact that the very people who are now being put in the position like defenders of masculinity, right? We need it. It's a martial quality. Without it, we wouldn't be able to defend ourselves against attackers and all of that. Is that simultaneously, nobody, I have a son, Noah has two sons, Christine, you have two sons. Like, nobody here doesn't believe that males left to their own devices and untrained by society may exhibit qualities of behavior and comportment that are antisocial and injurious to themselves and to others. So part of the whole point is that you interweave these boys into society. You teach them self-restraint. You teach them gentlemanly manners. You teach them how to be a mensch. Right. Mensch being the Yiddish, a very, you know, invocative Yiddish word that refers to being a good man in the largest possible sense, having good manners, having a certain amount of sensitivity, but it is not
decency.
Female. Right. But it is, these are not female qualities, which are themselves, you know, incredibly virtuous. But the process by which a boy becomes a civilized man is a knowing, conscious process. And that process, too, has been under assault for decades and decades.
It struck me just only now in talking about this that the guidelines are sort of like the anti Rudyard Kipling if. They are like the ultimate refutation of Kipling's poem If, which is which is this sort of checklist on how to bear a series of burdens, keep your head. And if you can do this almost impossible task, you will be a man.
You'll be a man.
But what's more, you'll be a man, my son. And none of it, nothing. I just looked it over. Not one bit of it is offensive. It's about
if you can keep your head about you while all others are losing theirs. Right.
That is the ultimate.
And blaming it on you.
Right. Yes. I mean, so you're getting it from both sides here. So masculinity is toxic. But the very efforts that society has made over the past centuries to enhance the good qualities of masculinity and to, allow them to hold sway over the more problematic aspects of masculinity have also been under assault forever. precisely by the culture that says that it's more important for you to express your, you know, to make voluble expression of your emotions. I mean, Irving Kristol used to say that his father, who was, you know, a working class guy and very reticent in all of this, his father never said, "I love you." His father never said, "I love you," and no one ever said, "I love you," and no one ever would think to say that, "I love you." But his father worked, you know, 15 hours a day, 6 days, and was perfectly kind and perfectly nice and perfectly civil. But he was a reticent human being. And he was a reticent human being, for all we know, because if he hadn't been a reticent human being, he could not have contained his emotions. He could not have dealt with the rawness of his feelings. And so therefore, you know, there's a gradation. Like, every person is different. Some people are more sensitive than others. Some people are more aggressive than others. Some people are more competitive than others. And among men and males and boys and everything like that, these gradations have to be dealt with. That's what the process of civilizing people is about.
Maybe the most important point in Christine's piece is that this is an effort to divert, and a diversionary effort from the real problems that are that socializing young men are struggling with, which is in schools and in popular culture and in toy stores, where you can't find a male toy now in just aisles and aisles of female toys, is that people are afraid of how young boys socialize with one another by instinct. I mean, if you are raising young boys, they're physical with one another. They're rambunctious. They're aggressive. And that's something that they're born with. It's intuitive. It's not something that's affected by socialization. And we're trying to impose socialization on those behaviors as though it's something we can fix when we can't.
And ironically, we're doing it at a time where, as Steven Pinker and others have pointed out, rates of violence in society are way down compared to previous eras, right? We're actually much less violent and much less aggressive than we used to be. So further sort of feminizing boys to get them to behave in a way that's seen as less, you know, quote unquote, toxic is really not necessary. And I think both John and Noah and Abe are all correct in that there are definitely challenges for young men in particular as they make their way to adulthood. But you actually want them, as well as young women, but you really want them reading Stoic philosophy, because it does teach them how to bear discomfort and teach patience and being long-suffering. These are not values that our culture is very good at transferring these days, but they are values that we need in a civilized republic. So I think that this idea that we just need to throw out this old traditional masculinity and everybody should have a big old group hug. I mean, they talk about gender empathy and communication skills and all these things that men are supposed to be trained to do. But Toby Young in The Spectator noted that, look, this report uses the word transgender more than it uses the word masculine. I mean, there's something wrong there, right?
I would add that I don't know anybody who suffers silently and stoically more so than women. My wife has struggled with some physical problems right now for all her life, and I only found out about them 6 months ago.
Yeah, okay, but one of the funny aspects of this, of course, is that if you had a report of this sort, okay, let's go back to this is some version of a historical act of revenge, because, of course, the first half of the psychological era in the United States, as sort of designed by Freud and Freudians, conveyed an enormous sense of personal damage and injury to women for qualities that we now know are totally mythological, like penis envy and, you know, the idea that over-mothering causes autism and stuff like that. So women were victimized the first half of this period in which we believe that the unconscious governs the conscious, and it's more important to understand the unconscious motivations than to actually take account of what people do on a day-to-day basis in their own activities, was very misogynistic. And, you know, one of the reasons I think that feminism caught on in the way that it did, I don't mean, you know, because of equal pay and equal work, but I mean because of what the general sense that the culture was tipped in the balance of men in an unfair fashion, was precisely because people started saying, well, wait a minute. You know, and Abe and I have been talking about this in relation to the literature of the 1950s and 1960s, because he's working on a piece about Saul Bellow. And if you think about the great American writers of the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, that would be Bellow, Mailer, Roth and John Updike, one of the things that unites all of them is a loathing of women in a way that literary that any writer today would be reviled, you know, or at least wildly controversial for expressing as a matter of course the idea of kind of frigidity, you know, sort of how a cold woman is also sexually frigid and is therefore, is therefore bad because she doesn't allow her mate to express himself sexually.
No, really, in Bellow's case, and this also relates to the point about the Freud stuff. It goes back. I mean, all the Freudian stuff, in some sense, is culturally an outgrowth of earlier mythologies about women as witches and sort of, you know, mysterious evil forces generally.
Yeah, and the Madonna whore and all that. But I just think in the end, you have an interesting aspect of this, which is, you know, imagine somebody proposing the theory of penis envy in 2019. Right. But I mean, this is in some sense a kind of, bizarro world version of that. Yeah. In which all being female is a hunger about the damage of not being male that is done to your psyche,
right.
And now it's that being male is damage and you need to be more female.
Right, pathologizing half the population.
Yeah, one way or the other.
Yeah. Doesn't that suggest that it's temporary then? That in however long time we'll look back on it.
Is anything temporary?
Anything not temporary?
Is anything temporary? One sense of these kind of cultural moments and is that everything just gets folded into a kind of, the people who want to believe it will believe it, and the people who don't want to believe it won't believe it. But you know, what are the authorities going to do? What are what are people in schools going to do?
Well, I mean, I'm thinking.
What are you
going to
do?
Like,
her great example in the piece is what if a dad takes his son out hunting? And then the parents get divorced, and the wife says, says to the judge, my husband took my son out hunting. And he's like, oh, well, he can't have custody because, you know, he's
doing
classical male violence. And
it depends on the state you're in. I mean, divorce court is tilted against the men dramatically in blue states.
Right. Well, whatever.
Okay. But, yeah, I mean, I just came across a piece today that was one of these clickbaity pieces. It's like, science says this is the ideal diet for you. And all you know that in 10 months, science is going to say something else because science doesn't say anything.
Yeah, but this issue of what is the proper relationship, societal relationship between men and women and the deepest expression of who they are is the subject of Western civilization in general forever. And so the question doesn't go away. I mean, people can go, oh, that's ridiculous. I'm not eating grapefruit, 17 times a day. But like, what you do when you want to court, when you're a male and you want to go court a woman, which is now, now a subject for courts as well as for, one's deepest psychic fears and, personal exposure. And I think to myself when I was a young man, starting to date, and I was terrified enough as it was of what to do at the end of the date if I wanted to, if I wanted to make clear my romantic interest and I wanted to kiss, it was already terrifying to have to sort of cross this barrier, invisible barrier between you and between me and the woman and sort of do something. And now I'd be sitting there thinking, am I going to go to jail? what's going to, am I doing something that's going to get me in trouble later? What am I supposed to, it's already a nightmare. It was already a nightmare before this. Noah's rolling his eyes because it wasn't a nightmare for him.
I'm agreeing.
Oh, okay.
No, and it makes me think.
I'm rolling because I'm remembering that experience too.
It makes me think of another really bad aspect of this, which is that, so now, like, what happens when the young boys who are somehow affected by these guidelines and this whole dynamic, like, so they are handled in the way that the APA suggests, and they go forward into the world, and they're not doing very well. They're at a grave disadvantage to the males who grew up, sort of, with some more quote traditional sort of masculine understanding of how to handle things, and they're better equipped.
Well, I'll give you the best example of this in terms of the cultural confusion of the present moment. there was a piece in The Atlantic the other day about upper middle class parenting. The whole question of, you know, do we upper middle class parents, do we are we overly involved in our children's lives, and are we helicoptering, and, you know, we don't let them do anything on their own, and it's so terrible, and so things seem to suggest that they're less capable and they're more snowflakey and all of that. And yet, on the other hand, what if it's good for them? See, if it's good for them because they do better in school and they get better grades and they go to better schools, then this is all an expression of economic inequality, because only well-to-do parents have the resources that make it possible for them to be helicopter parents, because less well-to-do parents have to work harder. And maybe less well-to-do parents aren't in two-parent homes for the most part, so the two parents can divide the parenting responsibilities. So if it's good for you and it helps to have involved parents who are paying close attention to you, that's unfair, because the people – and this is the ultimate thing, which is we're talking about whether masculinity is toxic. The problem in this country is that fathers are abandoning, you know, 50% of fathers of new that have no relation with their children. That's, you know, that's the elephant in the room. You want to talk about the problem being maleness? It's that the one thing that males are supposed to do to perpetuate the species, aside from the mechanical act of creating life, they are not doing in large measure, and this is a multi-generational crisis.
And it wasn't long ago, I feel like, reading social science or psychological literature about how male socialization it hinges on having an involved male role model in your life as a child.
Right, and all these efforts to figure out who could do it, right? If the father wasn't there, was it sufficient to have somebody who was a big brother twice a week? Would that help? Is there any record or indication that provides even that, or a couple of afternoons, or an uncle, you know? And is there any record to suggest that this would prevent worse outcomes? Right. And I mean, that was a huge issue like 10 years ago. I don't know if it's still, I don't know who studies any of this, and I'm so now skeptical of all sociological and social science studies that it's very hard to...
Right, but what you bring up is amazing, because it points to literally the problem being a sort of absence of maleness.
Yeah, the problem is that the civilized masculinity that I talked about earlier, which is a necessary component of any healthy society, we really don't have, except it's a culturally stratified fact that the upper middle classes tend to have more intact families and more involved fathers and all that, and the lower classes do not. And this is the poverty. This causes poverty. It causes emotional instability and all of that.
And Christine, well,
and these boys, yeah, please. You know, these boys are already being raised, especially the ones who are most at risk, who don't have fathers in the home, and who are, you know, lower income groups. They're already living in an almost all female universe, because their elementary school teachers are almost all female. The administrators at the schools are almost all female, and they live in female headed households. So it's not as if they're not getting a pretty strong dose of female values right now, and yet they are still struggling. So I think it's absolutely crucial to raise this issue of boys having male role models and fathers having an active presence
if it works, that's the real question.
Well,
don't know if it works for it not to be fathers.
And for Christine, you end on this point, and I think it's a really valuable point, is that the backlash to this sort of thing is generating something that could be considered by everybody to be the toxic masculinity, which is these people without role models who are appealing to sort of the most caricatured versions of what a maleness is, a sort of aggressive maleness. And on the right, we see it a lot, is manifesting in misogyny, like outright misogyny.
Right.
Exactly.
Now, I want to finish for just a minute and a half on a totally unrelated subject, except that this is somebody who might actually come under the category of toxic masculinity, ex-Trump lawyer Michael Cohen, because I can't leave today without talking about the story in the Wall Street Journal about Michael Cohen and the fake poll. So the story is that Michael Cohen hired the IT director of Jerry Falwell Jr.'s Liberty University to try to manipulate the online polls at CNBC and Drudge in 2015 to show Trump winning stuff. And he told him he would pay him $50,000, but he gave him cash. He gave him $13,000 in cash and a glove from a martial arts or one of those Ultimate Fighting Championship champions, instead $13,000 and a glove, and he kept the other $37,000 for himself, and the guy in question never got the rest of the money. And then it turns out that in various other transactions, the story says Cohen skimmed money off, even in the Stormy Daniels payment, which was $130,000. He got $180,000. He got $50,000. He must have told them it was $180,000, and he then pocketed $50,000, which may be the part of the tax evasion charges against him. But anyway, so
he's... Forget the women for Cohen.
Right, and setting up a women for Cohen Twitter account about how sexy Michael Cohen is. So this week marks the 20th anniversary of the premiere of The Sopranos, by many people's lights, not mine, but by the greatest TV show ever made.
I am watching it right now for the very first time.
Okay, and
saw it at the time.
And is it
might be surprised to know it's very good.
Okay, it is extraordinarily good, and I saw every episode. I just don't think it's the anyway. But, and I don't think you're there with this guy yet, but Michael Cohen is Hesh the lawyer. That is who he is. And so I don't know what that means about who everybody else is in the story, but that is who he is. And he is clearly going to be entertaining us for some time to come, because of course he is going to make this big public appearance at a House hearing in February. And to defend him as a masculine person, he has now expressed fear, which I think is understandable, that his family might be at risk from this public appearance because, you know, people are crazy and who knows what they'll, you know, who knows what they'll do. Anyway, so with that, with that story of Hesh, the toxically masculine lawyer, we will bring this to a close. Please go to Amazon.com and pre-order your copy of Unjust by Noah Rothman, coming out in 2 weeks. We'll talk more about that next week. So for Christine Rose and Noah Rothman and Abe Greenwald, I'm John Podhoretz. Keep the candle burning.